Okay, so this is what I always call lesson zero because it has nothing to do with your workbook. You came here without having even seen your workbook. So it's an introduction to not only Ephesians, but to kinds of the underlying stuff that's going on in Ephesians. So you're not going to find this in any historical book or anything. It's a way to help you enter Ephesians with a different mindset. Particularly in the New Testament, I find people who have been Christians for a while, they seem to think they know what's going on. But we always enter it from our own mindset. So we always need to like shift those paradigms and shift back. So where do you think we're going to start?
Genesis.
We always start in Genesis. Genesis gives us a better idea of really what's going on. It's always the foundation. So we have started our studies from Genesis for years, and usually I look at a different little piece of Genesis. So that's kind of what we're going to do today. We're going to start in Genesis. So starting in Genesis 1-2, because the Word of God is God's story, not our story, unfortunately we use it often as our story. We use it as a self-help book. I think that's the most common way that Christians use Scripture. It was never written as a self-help book. It wasn't intended to be a self-help book. It's intended to be God's story. So that's why I like to start in Genesis, to remind us this is God's story. And in God's story, he displays to us who he is and what he does. And then he brings us into his story. And how we fit into his story is the rest of Scripture. So in Genesis 1, some of this may be a little bit of a review, but there's more to it. So today I want to talk about Genesis 1 that tells us who God is. And who God is cohortative. Now that's a really odd word. Most of you have heard this before. But most of you have heard the word cohort. It has a negative connotation in today's society. But in Scripture, it's actually a voice. So the voice, the cohortative voice, actually identifies for us who God is. When I say that, perhaps if you have your Bibles here, Genesis 1, 26. I'm sure a lot of you have heard sermons or studies talking about this verse, but I want to go a little deeper there. It says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness.'" So just stopping right there. A lot of times they focus on the us. And the word God, which is Elohim there, is a plural. But that's actually not where we get the idea of Trinity. That was a very common way of talking of God, no matter what God you were talking about. Where we get the idea is actually in the Hebrew here, the way that Hebrew is presented. And it's presented here in the cohortative voice. The cohortative voice means that there are several entities in here working together. So just as in a cohort, I'm in a cohort in school, there's several people within the cohort, but each person is not there for himself. Each person is there to build up the other so that the other builds the other and the other builds you. And it works in this great movement of building one another up. What we say is that in a cohort, each person is there to lift the worth up of the other. And so this is a description of who God is. He's cohortative. Within himself, there are persons that lift up the worth of the other. So we're going to talk about what that looks like. We've already talked about cohort. In my cohort, the longer we stay in this cohort, the more we lift one another up. One of our cohort members last week went to Disneyland, and ran a half marathon. So all the texts going on throughout the week were, you know, "We're praying for you, Becky. Oh, I hope you have fun, Becky." You know, all of this lifting her up because she was running a half a marathon. She was running half marathon dresses, R2-D2. She was a Star Wars. So it was a Star Wars marathon. And, of course, last night she brought the medal that she got, aww, you know, for participating, and it is really cool, especially if you're a Star Wars fan. Mm-hmm. It looks like the piece that Leia gives to one of, I don't know Star Wars well enough. Yeah. So it looks like that. It's really cool, really heavy, and then she showed us pictures, and we're all interested in that, and we're all cheering for her, you know, to do this. So other than that, in the cohort, we have papers to do. And in fact, the professors will say, I expect you to talk with one another about these and to help one another, so that somebody will say, I said this last paper, I don't know exactly what he's asking for. Could somebody give me an idea of what they think he's asking for? And so people chime in. I think this is what we're supposed to be doing here, and this is what we're supposed to be doing here. And everybody's involved in this, so that we're helping one another, and we want to be, as a cohort, one, and we consider ourselves one. So that's a cohort here. For God, being a cohort is, of course, even more involved and more intertwined. This relationship, it talks about the fact that God himself is relationship and that he upholds the relationship within himself. So we've talked about that before, but now I want to go a little deeper as to what that actually looks like. So I'm sure a lot of you have heard the word perichoresis, yes? No? Is this familiar? It's a Greek word, it's a Greek term. Perichoresis, peri means around, okay? So circle, kind of, just keep around in there. Choresis means, and those of you who have been through this before, you'll go, oh, that's so cool. Choresis means to give way or to make room. That should be familiar to you. So perichoresis, to go around in such a way that you make room for the other. So that is who God is. He is relationship in such a way that he makes room, that each person makes room for the other. But there are some caveats here. So we might think, because we have a Western mind, we often think this way, right? So we think Father, Son, Spirit, and they're all connected. But there's a problem with this. There's a start and there's a finish, right?
Yeah.
And on top of it, it's flat. So it only exists on one plane, and there's a start and there's a finish. It is not linear. Perichoresis is not linear. If it's linear, there's a problem because there is separation, right? There's no Father and Spirit aren't connected in any way. So it's not linear. So when you think about who God is, don't think this. Or actually, and I after thinking about this, I thought, you know, in our Western mind, we probably wouldn't even think linear so much as one on top of the other, right? And that's often how we think, right? Father, Son, Spirit. And we almost talk that way. It's not. And that's linear as well. It's not that. So think about that. So then, well, since peri means around, then what do we think? We think in circle. So that would be this. So we have a circle. Well, that seems to work. The problem is that there's partly hidden pieces. So circular means that there isn't vulnerability or openness. So we have Father, Son, and Spirit, but we don't see the inside of the Father, Son, and Spirit. So if I tilt it, you can see, right? Everyone has an inside, but you can't see it. It's not vulnerable. It's not open. So that the Father is sharing part of himself with the Spirit, and the Spirit's sharing part of himself with the Son, but not everything. So it's a problem for us to think about perichoresis in a circle. I've seen a lot of pictures and a lot of diagrams about perichoresis, and they talk about it as being a dance. But it's not a circular dance. So not linear, not circular. Perichoresis, can you think of what, any other way? It is three-dimensional. Ah, good, John. Yes, my mathematician there.
That's what I was thinking. I just didn't know.
So Mobius strip. Yeah. Does this. So everybody, first of all, it's everyone's going into everyone. There's connection everywhere. But it also is open, vulnerable. And it's motionable. It's always in motion. So a Mobius is always in motion. And does everyone know what a Mobius is? So it goes inside and outside. And it's almost when you're trying to trace it in your mind, you're thinking,
how can it do that?
How can it do that? Yeah. So, yeah, a lot of there are bracelets that are Mobius. But it's so the outside and then the inside, and they're all connected.
And never ending, right?
And never ending. You see, there's no beginning, there's no ending, right? And so I think Peggy said the infinity symbol comes from that. Remember that in covenant, he walks this thing. On top of that, it goes through all the planes, right? So it's not flat. It's not one-dimensional or two-dimensional. It's three-dimensional. It's actually more dimensional than that. So in perichoresis, nothing separates one person from the other in the Trinity. And this is important for our theology. Really important, as I'm having to talk with people about this because of the things that are going on at Wheaton College. Yeah. Nothing separates in God. In other words, if there is no Father, if it's only Son and Spirit, it's not God. If there's only Father and Son, there's no God. If it's only Spirit and Father, there's no God. If you leave one of them out, it's not God. Does that make sense? Because in perichoresis, in cohortative union, there is no separation of persons. There's no separation. It's always moving, always creating life because of its movement. If you take one out, you've lost perichoresis. You've lost cohortative. Two, even two within that, whatever two you want to choose, what's going to happen if there's two? Back and forth, right? It's going to be transactional. With this, no separation. There's also nothing that interrupts. It continues on. The interchange between the persons exists on all planes. So it is, if you think about a Mobius, the purpose of actually constructing something like this is to actually see motion. It's moving on every plane, and nothing interrupts it. A plane doesn't interrupt it. A flat surface or a vertical surface doesn't interrupt it at all. Nothing interrupts the flow here of that. So nothing separates, nothing interrupts. There's complete unity. And the unity is that there's intimacy. There is actually a connection between them. The intimacy, though, is reciprocal. So there's intimacy and reciprocity. The intimacy doesn't just go from Son to Father. It goes from Father to Son, from Son to Spirit, and Spirit to Son. So that because there's no beginning or ending, it goes both ways. Does that make sense? The direction. It's bidirectional. It goes all ways, and as it's always moving. And as I'm explaining this, I'm thinking about in Revelation, where they talk about the wheels of fire going around, almost like a gyro. That's kind of like that.
I think about an atom and how the electrons
that are going around
the nucleus are going in a whole cloud of every all
of all the directions. Yep,
all
exactly.
And it says Jesus holds together matter.
Yes.
And
yes.
This is the power of the atom, that it's held together by all of these
things. Right. Exactly. That's unity, right? That's exactly where Ephesians goes. So we have nothing separates, nothing interrupts, complete unity, but also full individuality. And that's important because even though they are connected to each other with complete intimacy and reciprocal with one another, you still can see, oh, here's the Son, here's the Father, here's the Spirit. they don't get absorbed into one another. So they don't get into a mush of that's all God, but it is one God. So we're thinking on a little bit different plane here than we normally think. We are linear thinkers, so sometimes it's a little bit hard to get that. But it's important that we know that the individuation of the persons in the Trinity are always consistently there. They share life with one another, but you can see each individual in the Trinity. So these are important for us to understand. Out of the perichoresis movement, as the Son is opening up to the Father, and the Father's giving to the Son, there is this flourishing that happens, right? So as I give to you and you give to me, we both expand and we become bigger. And that's what happens in this movement. So that in this movement, there is a consistently happening of creation. There's always more coming out of it. Because this is actually the definition of love. Is one giving to the other giving to their, both being open to being given to and open to giving. So this reciprocity of movement actually helps us to understand a little bit more really what love is. And that really negates some of the ideas that we have of love, some of the emotional ideas we have of love. But this growth and multiplication comes out of being in a Mobius-type perichoresis. Interesting enough, if for those of you who like dance, there is a movement in dance that does this. Anybody know what it's called? It's called a flourish. Well, isn't that interesting? Yeah. So that's a flourish. And obviously we can see what we're doing with our hands is a Mobius, right? And of course it's that infinity symbol. You know, symbols have to be two-dimensional, so it's flat, but it's meant to be this. So that's called a flourish in dance. And I love that. And like Pat pointed out with the atoms, you're going to find more and more, oh, wait, this is how the world works. The world works this way, or at least it's supposed to work this way. Interesting that we have the reflections of who God is all over the place, even in our language, when we don't know it. I mean, whoever named this flourish probably wasn't going, oh, we should name this flourish because that's what God happens in a Mobius and that's who God is.
Right.
No, but remember that God has planted eternity within our hearts. So no matter who you are, you have some of that truth. And it comes out. I was just reading an article in that magazine I just gave you about an architect who is trying to describe the ways of building actually bring in that life. And some ways of building don't. So very interesting that in all walks of life, we learn that this actually occurs or is supposed to occur. So that is a little window of who God is. It's important that we know that before we go into Ephesians, because Ephesians talks about unity and wholeness. So when we talk about unity, we need to understand that's the unity we're talking about. What does he do? As we look at Genesis 1 and 2 again, we know that the first thing he does is creates, but he creates not by thinking. It doesn't say God thought about waters, but he spoke. He had a physical act. In theology, you call that a speech act. So that you ground it in the fact that he actually acts and not just thinks. And he creates life, and he creates life to mimic who he is, to look like who he is. It's interesting that in Genesis 2, 1 and 2, 4, and we don't think about this until we've realized what a whole creation is, that he affirms that he created heaven and earth, heaven and earth, and we separate those two. But in Genesis, heaven and earth are together. They're one unity. They're completely together. And that is going to play a part in Ephesians as well, because we're going to see where he's bringing us to our wholeness, this heaven and earth together. So he acts, he speaks life, and then he rules with vulnerability. And what I mean by that is, we've talked about ruling before, is that what he does with what he creates. He makes sure to involve them in perichoresis. He makes sure to involve them in that kind of whole life. And he does that by three things. Most of you should know this. What are the three things he does? Names, worth, tens, multiplies, makes space, right, for flourishing. So in Genesis 1:28, he names worth in them. He names worth in them several times, but the first time he says, God blesses them. Now, it doesn't mean that he just thought, oh, I'm going to do good for them. He actually does something in blessing them. He tends them by giving them access to everything they'll need to live a perichoresis life. He gives them access to everything they'll need for that. He doesn't force them. He doesn't put food in their mouth and chew it for them. He gives them access to them. That's the tending, right? We tended one semester everybody's plants, right? That giving care, paying attention to what they need and what they need access to. And then the making space, he makes space for them to flourish by giving them freedom. So he says, here's access to everything you need. So in the garden, he says to Adam and Eve, here are everything you need for flourishing. Now you get to choose. And that's the making space to flourish. You get to choose whether you want to be in this perichoresis or not. You get to choose whether you want to take advantage of being in me and me in you. So he has this accessibility for flourishing, and then the choice, the freedom to take advantage of what that is. He does not force it. It is always, for God, giving space is always an offering. It's always, here you go. Here it is for you. It's open hand. So that's just a little bit of window into who God is and what he does. And then, of course, we know that God includes man into his story, creating us in his image. Well, if he creates us in his image, then we must look something like God looks, some coordinative form. In Genesis 2, it says that he breathes his breath into us, his ruach, or his nefesh, into us. His breath is also the name for spirit. So he actually, within that perichoresis, he puts this into us. He breathes into us his spirit, which means we get to participate in that perichoresis as he created us to be. But we're free. We're free to participate in that or not. We're free to allow him to be in us and us to be in him. And of course, I mean, this is, you know, going through long times of theology, but we know that man chose not to be a part of that perichoresis. He chose to separate from that. And so the temptation for man was believing, hearing that the possibility of having more power in a separation rather than a unity, rather than this perichoresis, that if I have this spirit, maybe if I just take it out, I might have more power myself. I want something to issue out of me, but I don't want something for me to issue out of somebody else. Perhaps there's more power. That was the temptation that Satan presented to them. There's more power in being separate than having shared power. So this is a very, very powerful entity within creation. But when we look at it, particularly in the way we think, how many times have you been in a group where you all have to work together and you think, I can just do this myself? a lot faster, right? And probably better. So you all have exactly what Adam and Eve had. Huh, I think there's a little more power if I'm separated rather than... I mean, I know that so many of you have at one time or another moaned and groaned. Are you kidding? We have to work together on this? This is my grade, right? A cohort doesn't look at it that way. A paraphrasis doesn't look at it that way. But that is the temptation of the human being and our free will. And so, of course, we know that man shows the separate path. I want to be separate from paraphrasis. And what was it that actually made the separation? Was it their thinking?
Their action.
It was a physical act that actually broke the paraphrasis. It was a physical act that broke the paraphrasis. So, in doing that, our manifestation of God was broken. We no longer looked like this. We still had the components, but we are now broken into
all. Okay, what does that mean?
Our reflection of God, of who we are, we are made in God's image, but it's a broken image. It's like a mirror, like we're a mirror, but we broke it into separate pieces.
So how is the paraclesis broken in us?
We separated.
When Eve took the bite, that did that?
Yep. That's what happened for us.
For us, yeah.
So I'm going to give you a little bit more of an idea on that. But that's what we did. Remember, because we had the choice to, mm-hmm. because God gave us that choice. Do you want it? I'm giving you my spirit so that you're in this, but we said no. Let's see what it's like. In doing so, God said, that's not whole, and because I'm love, I can only want wholeness, mm-hmm. so I'm going to reconstruct man. And, of course, reconstructing man happens in Jesus Christ. And so we have God reconstructing humanity within his own story so that Jesus gets made in our image. So now things are flipped, right? We are made in his image, and now Jesus gets made in our image. And so we have Emmanuel penetrating humanity. So in the conception of Jesus Christ, he actually penetrates humanity. And I should, a lot of times if you read about perichoresis, one of the definitions of perichoresis is mutual penetration. Sounds sensual, right? Mm-hmm. It's actually meant to be. Because when we think about that, we think about what happens when penetration happens is life. Mm-hmm. So mutual penetration. So now we have God recreating man by penetrating himself into humanity. So we have God putting himself into man. So when you think about what's happened, that's an even more amazing thing. So it's not just about Mary bearing the Son of God. It's about God penetrating into broken humanity. And when he penetrates with this. So he goes into humanity for the purpose of us being able to be into him once again. So it's the beginning of recreating us into that perichoresis. Have I lost anybody yet?
I wanted to ask, Joe, real
yes.
quick, when we took the bite to separate ourselves from perichoresis, the spirit, though, God breathed his spirit in us. Mm-hmm. The spirit is still in us. We just choose not to be part of the
Yes, kind of. So let me go on and see if I think I'll answer it within there. We're not sure what to do with that spirit now.
Okay.
So we'll look at that.
In us?
Yes. So just hang.
Latent. I see that in Mary.
It's like there.
You know, God penetrated Mary. Mary grew Jesus, birthed Jesus. Mm-hmm. But and I'm sure you'll get there. Tell us more about how he penetrates us today.
So. Christ is conceived within Mary. He penetrates. So remember that Jesus is called the second Adam. So he's flipping, right, everything. So that he's getting us back into that. as Jesus lives and ministers, he's breathing in the Spirit, showing us. So as Jesus lives, he's living like this, showing us it's actually possible for us to commune this way. It's actually possible for that Spirit to be connected with all of parts of God. Showing us that the spiritual can be known again. Because what happens with here is, we can't be known. I hope I didn't. When God breathed into us, he breathed us as an image of him, right?
Right.
So we look just like him. And this is how we call it, right? Mm-hmm. Mind, body, spirit. Mm-hmm. Right? You've heard that before. That's who we are. But we cut it off. We're not a perichoresis. We're sometimes like this. We'll talk about that in a minute. When Christ comes, he inserts himself into humanity. So it's not just into Mary, but it's into humanity. Because as Adam grew humanity, so the second Adam grows humanity in there. So the possibility of us living that way. But right now, he comes into this. And he comes into a body right into the middle there. And he shows us that body and spirit and mind can actually be connected and commune with one another. So that we might be in him once again. That's his life. That's his birth and his life. His breathing the Spirit in continually. Jesus' life is super important for us to be able to see that. We talk about his birth, and we focus definitely on his death and resurrection. Mm-hmm. But rarely do we talk about his life. And the interesting thing is, when we talk about the Gospels, we talk about the fact that he died for us, right? Mm-hmm. Except that's a really small part of the Gospel. Mm-hmm. The Gospel is mostly about his life. All four Gospels. And it's important because it's the place that we get to see this in bodily form, how the perichoresis works. That it's possible for the human being in his body to actually be in perichoresis. So that's really important there. When he dies, what's the last thing that happens on the cross when he dies? He gives up his spirit. Okay, if he's like this on the cross and he gives up his spirit, what's he doing? This is the place for man to be in him. He's giving space. Come on in. It's as if they're holding hands, and that for that one time he lets go and he says, come in the perichoresis again. Within my body, you can be in this perichoresis again. I'm letting go of my hand from the spirit so that in my body you can be in me and be in that perichoresis. So you see, the birth is important, and the life is important, and the death is important. Not one, but all three. So even in his life, we see this idea of perichoresis going on and the way that we enter back into that. So he makes that connection for us. But it is that receiving of it that we have to.
Jill, does that have to do anything when he says, Father, why have you forsaken me?
Yes.
This broken communion.
Exactly. So think about that. He's always been that. And all of a sudden having to do this.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he first says, have you forsaken me? He knows that's what the Father's asking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm coming into you so that you can do this. And that's a huge deal for him to do that.
And isn't communion a reminder of him grabbing our hands?
Yes. And we're going to talk about that. The fact that some of the things that we do within worship are very bodily, right? For us.
Right.
Our body has so much to do with us receiving. So much to do. We have not made that the gospel. We've made the gospel in our mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jesus yields up his spirit. So that we can participate in him. And in so, he deconstructs or cracks into our mortality. We're mortal because we chose to be, because we chose not to eat out of the tree of life. We chose to eat out of a knowledge tree. And that has a lot to do with Ephesians, this knowledge. And he's going to tell us there's a different way of knowledge than you're thinking. And he cracks that open. So what I want to do, so one of the things in Ephesians is we're going to talk a lot about poetry. So I hope a lot of you like poetry because you're going to be bringing in poetry. But this poetry I found, and I just thought, I cannot believe it. This is the perfect poem. So it's called the Christmas Preface, or actually it's Preface. I'm going to read it, but I want you to pay attention to the words, and I want to see if you see what's going on in this poem. We're going to talk about poetry because Ephesians starts with a poem, and then it talks about us as poems. So we are going to talk a lot about poetry. Poetry does something that regular prose doesn't do. It actually makes pictures, but with some kind of a rhythm, right? Mm-hmm. So it actually dances. So poetry dances. It's meant to dance. I know that some of you are probably going, oh, I hate poetry. All I can tell you is probably someone taught you poetry that didn't love poetry. Poetry is something that actually moves. When we do prose, prose moves linear. When we do poetry, it moves much more in periacrisis. This one in particular. So, there in the haze warmth and the steaming sty, the word born to the frailty of flesh cracks our mortality with a weak cry and seals our life within his endlessness. The word born to the frailty of flesh, he lies wrapped in the cloth of mystery and seals our life within his endlessness in infant finitude eternity. He lies wrapped in the cloth of mystery, the straining of small limbs, unopened eyes, in infant finitude, eternity, and love invisible we recognize. The straining of small limbs, unopened eyes, draws us from torchlight to the light of glory, and love invisible we recognize, shaping the child's dream of the Christmas story. Draw us from torchlight to the light of glory. Crack our mortality with a weak cry. Shaping the child's dream of the Christmas story here in the haze warmth and the steaming sty. Where do you see perichoresis here?
It keeps repeating. The second line used in the first, and the second line used in the next verse. Mm-hmm. And then also the third moved to the fourth.
Right. So everybody see that? So the second line, the word to the frailty of flesh, begins the second stanza. The last line, and seals our life within his endlessness, is the third line in the second stanza. But more than that, then we wrap it around. The second line in the first stanza is the first line in the second stanza. The third line is the, where is it? Toward the end. So if you actually had to map this out, it would end up like this. Mm-hmm. It would end in a Mobius. Mm-hmm. When I saw this, I just thought, oh my goodness, that is just, not only that, it tells the story of what Christ does here, that he cracks our mortality with a weak cry and seals our life within his endlessness. It actually, in its words, talks about this mutual penetration, that he's coming into us so that we can be into him. Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm. Do you see how it dances and actually brings these words, like it fills out the idea of the manger scene? Mm-hmm. I thought that was a great physical way to show perichoresis within the world, so that we actually can write like that.
How'd she come across this? She must have been thinking.
You know what? So.
Well, it is a poetry form.
Yeah, it is poetry. Dan, do you have that first things that I just gave you? Uh-huh. So I think most of you know that this is always in my bathroom. So I get first things, which is, I told you before, this is like deep theological writings. Probably the deepest and best theological writings I've read in a magazine. Really, really good. And was in here. And I read their poem. I mean, there's some poetry in here. There's usually one or two poetry in here, which are always interesting. But I just read through this, you know, here, there. And I read that, and I stopped, and I thought, why is that so beautiful? And I read it again, and I went, there it is. It's Perichoresis. It just, but again, God always does that, right? He always brings up what he wants to teach us. So I hope that helps you see that, particularly as we continue to talk about poetry and movement. So all that background is necessary so that we understand as we come into Ephesians what we're talking about when we talk about unity, what we talk about when we're talking about body. And we're going to continue to use these strips so that we get a little bit more idea. But we need to look at just a little bit about the background of Ephesians. So Ephesians, we know it as the letter to the Ephesians. Probably not written to the Ephesians. The actual first three oldest manuscripts don't have the word Ephesians on there. There is no recipient. It was found in Ephesus. And they did find some manuscripts that had to the Ephesians on there, which tells historians that it was a circular letter. So it was meant to be read for all of those Asian communities there. Ephesians ends up with probably one of the copy of it. Remember that when Paul would write letters, sometimes he would write letters to all the churches in the area, and they were to circulate them. But they would also copy them for themselves. It was probably found in Ephesians because Ephesians was one of the largest Roman colonies at the time. One thing we have to remember is we are now in Roman territory. We're not in Israel. So that's a mistake if we make that. If we think about Ephesians and we think about Israel, not paste. We're in Roman Greco world right now. We're in Ephesians, which is in the West as far as Israel is concerned. So it was a universal letter, which meant it was meant for all the churches in that Asia Minor area. Most of these churches would have been Gentile churches. Mostly Gentile churches. The city of Ephesus was, again, one of the largest cities. It had, at the time of this writing, about 400,000 citizens. So that would have made it the third or maybe the fourth largest city in Rome, in the Roman Empire. So when you think Roman Empire, think all the areas that touch the Mediterranean. So that includes Spain, Africa, Israel, Syria, Turkey, Greece, Italy, all of that. That's the Roman Empire. And so within that Roman Empire, Ephesus is like, I think, third or fourth. I think it's the fourth largest city, so with 400,000 people. So it's a major city, and it's not only is it a major city in Rome, I'm not going to go too deep into this, but in Rome, Rome had lots of different ways of governing this gigantic empire. To some of the places, they gave a lot of autonomy. And they let them keep their languages and their ways of doing things, and their ways of government. So they didn't make them do their kind of government. They kept their government. Ephesus was one of these. So Ephesus was very autonomous. And it was actually a Greek city. So it's in what was Macedonia then. For our purposes, Macedonia and Greece are the same. They're actually not, but they're all Hellenistic. So it's really a Greek city, which makes a difference in how we know what's going on there. So it's a Greek city. It's got its own autonomy. It's large, and it holds to some of the structures of the Greco-Roman world. So again, we're talking Greco-Roman world. We're not talking Jewish world. The Greco-Roman structure is hierarchical. We're pretty used to that. We know what hierarchical is. It's top man on top, a lot of people on the bottom. It's always top down. It's always one direction. So power comes from here always and goes down. That means the people on the bottom have very little power. Power in the Roman Greco world is manifested in two places. It's manifested in government and it's manifested in family. So both government and family mirror this power structure, the way that things are set up, so that it's a top-down hierarchy. And there is a large gap in that hierarchy between the top and the bottom, a large gap. So that's the power structure. The religion is important. Everyone had religion. We've talked about this before. The word religion means religio, to retie. And what it what is being retied? Reality. So reality is being retied. Well, what's reality? This is reality. And now man, through religion, tries to retie it. Actually, reality would be this. We've separated so much, we don't know what goes where, and we're trying to retie it. So that's what religion is. Religion is trying to retie reality, to trying us to get back to wholeness. We don't know what wholeness is, but we know that there must be some connection to all of that. Within the hierarchy, the top part of the hierarchy in Roman Greco world was considered the spiritual. So anybody at the very top was actually considered divine. So we start this out with Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar claims that he is God, revealed. And that is how the Roman Greco world considers power, is the highest power is divine. There is actually a manifestation of God. With Julius Caesar being God, Augustus is his son. And so Augustus is known as the Son of God. So that was his title. Augustus, the Son of God. August means, has a lot of power because I am the Son of God. So with the top power in the structure being considered divine, it happens in the family as well. So although the family, the structure is husband, wife, children, slaves, the father is considered somewhat divine. He's not worshipped as divine, but he is certainly appeased as divine. So that is the type of structure. You need to know that, so that when we get into Ephesians 5, and everybody has trouble with what Ephesians 5 says about the family structure, we'll understand what he's talking against, and what kind of structure he's talking about. So, if humanity's attempt to put everything back together somehow is religion, they're searching for wholeness. They know God has put eternity within humanity's heart. We know that there is a place of wholeness. We just don't know how to put it together. And so we're going to have a couple different ways of putting it together within the ancient world. Know this, in the ancient world, atheism was not a thing. No one was atheist. That's a fairly new concept. But even if it were, atheism is still a religion in that atheism tries to put reality together. They just say, atheism says, well, there is no such thing as this. We're just trying to put these two together. So atheism is still trying to retie reality. They just have said that there is no such thing as spiritual. There's just mind and body, and we're just trying to put that together. So it's still a religion. So here are the religions of the ancient world. So there is an agnostic approach. Well, let's go back to that. Gnostic, or gnosis, is the Greek word for knowledge. So agnostic says without knowledge. What they say is that we know that mind and body are connected because we can see that and we can feel that. We know they're connected somehow. But we don't think, although we know this is a part of us, we don't think we can ever know how to commune with it. We don't have the ability to know how to be in union with the Spirit. So that's what agnostic means, without knowledge. We don't have the knowledge, the ability to be in communion with the Spirit. That was, for most of the ancient time, that was how we religion looked at it. We looked at, so it kind of looked like this. We know it's part of us, but we know it's not intimately part of us. How it looked in the Roman Greco world is the emperor cult, in which I talked about Julius Caesar being divine, his son being the son of God, and from there on, all the emperors took on the divine role, and they considered themselves God. The people considered them God. And then there were all sorts of other gods. So remember, we're in a pantheistic world. We know there's a lot going on in the spirit world, so there must be a lot of gods there. So this agnostic approach is shown in the family structure as well as the political structure and in religion and how we looked at religion. It was it still stayed very linear as far as how people thought about the connection, that it was a linear connection. For them, body, because it was what they knew and what they could feel, was really the big deal. It's where self was, in the body. So self was in the body, and so it was, the body was the one way that they could keep the spirit connected, but still distant. So the spirit is distant. There's no way we can ever have communion with the spirit, but there is a way that we can at least keep it connected. And that connection is always distant. When we talk about agnostics today, agnostics believe that God doesn't have really much to do with us, right? He's out there, but there's no intimate connection. And we don't have intimate connection with him. So we just live our lives and he's out there somewhere. That's what this looks like. Since they felt that the Caesars were gods, as well as the many other Greek gods that there were, they dealt with a linear way of living by appeasing the gods. I want to make sure that they're still around because they have more power than us. But we also want to make sure they're separate as well. So appeasement is the religion, the way that religion works. And that is that your body does whatever the spirit needs. So whatever the gods need or whatever Julius Caesar needs or whatever whoever is ruler at the time needs or wants, you give that to him. So appeasement is always about doing ritual. So a pious man during that time is not a moral man. He is a ritual man. He is a man who does all the rituals. And if the gods of your city happen to be Bacchus, if that's the god, one of the gods, then your body will do whatever Bacchus wants you to do to appease him, to make him happy. Do you know who the god Bacchus is?
Drinking wine.
So to be a pious man and appease Bacchus, what would you do? You would drink a lot. You would be drunk all the time. That would be a pious man. Now, for us, we're like, but remember, they are trying to retie and keep that spirit world happy. So there were lots of gods that would have been sexual in nature. And so to be a pious person would then be to go visit the prostitutes at the temple. That would be piety. It had nothing to do with what you thought or what you felt or inside. Being pious is keeping the gods happy by doing whatever their god over. So that really what counts is what your body does, not what your mind thinks or what you feel. that would be a pious person. You would be keeping the peace between that. Does this make sense to you? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now I'm talking to you as a Western, right, philosopher in reason. But there was another thing. So appeasement always then focused on the future. I want to make sure that you're doing good for me, God, whatever the God is. So I'll do what you need. So there's always a transaction in an agnostic religion, in an appeasement. So if God says this is what he loves, this is what makes him happy, then I'll do whatever makes him happy so that he gives me something good. So another thing that you need to know about the Roman Greco world is it works on the patronage system. So if you are a Chicago citizen, you know very well what the patronage system is. That is an ancient Roman Greco way of setting up government. That means, what does patronage system do? There's benefactors who have power to give, and the patrons underneath, the clients, make sure that they do something to make them happy so that they give them. So in Chicago, how does that work? I want to have a nice, cushy job. I want to say that I'm on the payroll of the governor or of the mayor.
Oh, you can.
And you can. And so you will vote the way he wants you to vote. You will make sure that all of your neighbors do this. And then he gives you this nice title that has $200,000 a year for your salary for doing nothing. That's patronage system. That's what was happening here. That's how they felt. That's what God. So they would see the mayor of the city as a god, as their patron. We hear patron saints, right? This is where it comes from. The patron has power to give. What are you going to give them? So it's this transactional idea. That's the appeasement idea of religion for them. Always focused on the future, right? If I do this, later I'll get this. I'll get good. Always focus on the future. Ephesus was the center of one of the biggest gods at the time, and that was Artemis. So Artemis was a goddess. The largest temple to Artemis was in Ephesus. So we have really Ephesus, and this is why I think it's come down to us as the letter to the Ephesians, because Ephesus kind of stands as a symbol of all the rest. So they are the center of Artemis worship. They have the biggest temple. And it's very obvious. And Artemis is a god of war and love together. So we do a lot of things for Artemis to make her happy. We like to do battles, and we also like to do the prostitutes. In this patron system. But within Ephesus and within all the Asia Minor area at the time, there were lots and lots and lots of people being very sick, what they considered being being traumatized by spirits. So we talk a lot about the spiritual world here because we think anything who has power is spiritual. So there was a lot of exorcisms going on. And Ephesus was also the center of the magic. So of this, a lot of exorcisms, which they called magic, which we would call magic. It was prevalent throughout the empire. And magic was another way to deal with the gods. It was another way to deal with the spiritual realm. Remember, when they talk spiritual realm, they talk power, more power than I have. So they're up here, we're down here. And something that happened to my physical body, because I love this body, remember the body is a big deal for them, anything that happens to it had to have come from the gods. And actually, there's a mediator between the gods, and the mediator between the gods are the demons. So that's where demons are just like little messengers. And they inflict people with diseases. So there are lots and lots of diseases, but all diseases were considered spiritual. In order to deal with that, so something in the past has happened, you're afflicted with some disease, that's a past thing. I don't want that anymore, so in the future, I want to be healed, I want to be whole, so magic would come in. And magic started out as formulas of chance. So it would be chance. If you say this, this many times, for this long, then the spirit will leave you and you'll be healed. So that was magic. Eventually it got into drugs. So when you talk about magic in the New Testament, think first formulas, saying things over and over and over again to relieve yourself of the spiritual oppression. Again, very focused in both past and future. Very focused there. It's all about doing the right thing the right way. So the chants had to be said exactly this way, this many times. That's what matters, doing the right thing the right way. What I want you to begin to hear is some of the little things that leak into our own way of dealing with spiritual, right? Dealing with God. It's all about just doing the right thing the right way. I mean, we do that, right? We think it's about doing the right thing. And we're going to get into a little bit about that personal piety idea. But that was, even though their piety looked very different than ours, we still get into that same kind of thing. If we behave right, right, God will be good to us, right? I mean, really, all of us have thought that way at one time or another, if not a lot. That's an agnostic way to approach God. Now, within this time, all of a sudden, Eastern religions are starting to come in. And Eastern religions are very mystic. So when I talk about mystic, so remember that Gnostic looks like this. Mystic religions say, no, we actually think you can have communion with the Spirit. We do think there can be some union with the Spirit. There is a possibility of doing that. But for Gnostics, for people who looked at, and Gnostic, that's knowing, is the way to get the spirit in communion is actually for the mind to be connected with that. If I know special things, if I know certain truths, then the spirit and the mind can be connected. So what they would do with what the agnostic says is they would say, no, spirit can be known by special knowledge. And so that spirit and mind are back to back. And body is just like, don't really know what to do with this body. But we know that we're going to be connected. So a Gnostic would actually make a circle. But they would make a circle with that spirit being inside. And the spirit touches the mind. So that as the mind and the spirit come together. And what they would say is, see, now there's communion. Now there's around and around and around. But just like here, what happens there, and this is how a Gnostic would attempt to religio, to reattach reality, is it would keep on going around and around and around. And the body is really denigrated. We don't think there's any use for the body. It can't connect to the spirit. So there's no use for it. So in going around and around and around, it would be like a dryer. So think about a spin cycle, right? Around and around and around and around. What's happening with that? In the spin cycle, what's happening with the dirty water? It's shooting away, right? So for a Gnostic, they say they want a distance from the body because it can't connect to the spirit. So in this around and around and around, their purpose is get rid of the body. Eventually get rid of the body because it doesn't have anything to do with the spirit. It can't connect to the spirit. So we don't want to go around and around. We want to keep going in this union until the body gets spinned off. And the spirit and mind actually get absorbed into one another. So that this special knowledge is still transactional. It just says the currency now is not acts in the body, it's thinking. If I think in a higher consciousness, if I think the right things, I will connect with the spirit. And in connecting with the spirit, I'll have this nice circular way of living. It will be a wholeness. And I'll just keep going and going and going until finally that body just spins off. And it's just the spirit and mind together as one, together. And what happens is we don't have a perichoresis. We can't, there's no individuation. There's spirit and mind as one. The Eastern religion that came over were very mystic, saying we could have that. And what happens in the Greek-Roman world is that philosophy comes in. So remember, philosophy starts in the Greek world. In fact, it starts very close to Ephesus. And with Aristotle in Macedonia, which is very close there. And so we have the idea of philosophy says you can't escape spiritual powers and evil against you. You can make them one with you by this circular way until you're absorbed into one. So what really matters is what's in my head, and we would say in my heart, not what my body does. It's really what's in my heart that matters. Now, that's a Gnostic way of actually communing with God. Would you say we have any Gnostic ideas in our Christianity? We absolutely do. This is where the idea of salvation is God rescuing me out of this bodily world into a spiritual world. That's a Gnostic idea. That is not a perichoresis idea. That is a Gnostic idea. That we are really, it's just about our spirit, and that God will eventually take us away from this material world and give us a new spiritual world to live in. That is not what God says is unity.
Isn't there a lot of thought that the body is the weakest? So, you know, you've probably heard the phrase, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak.
Yes, yes.
So I don't know if that feeds that.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that. A wholeness is that all of these are intertwined, weaving together, all equal, right? The more, if you start reading scripture with this in mind, you will begin reading some of these passages that you know so well, and you'll think, oh, wow, this is very different than I'm thinking, because we think in a very Gnostic way. Sometimes we think in agnostic ways. Mostly we think in Gnostic ways, mainly because we're Western, coming out of Western philosophy. So that's what philosophy brought. The Eastern religion and philosophy came together in the West there, in Asia Minor, in the Roman Empire. That's what Paul is talking to, is either people in the agnostic mindset or the people in the Gnostic mindset. That it's either all about what my body does, the rituals I do, or it's all about what's in my heart. And what Paul is saying is, no, you have access to a wholeness. You have access to not a circular way that eventually gets absorbed into, I mean, we hear about this in like New Age ideas of getting sucked into the consciousness of the world. But really, our churches are very, very Gnostic. We do talk, we really, this is more of how we live. We don't like to use those words, but it is how we live. Spirit is always inside, right? Right, God's spirit's inside. Ephesians is going to blow that out of water. No, spirit's actually in how you walk. You're walking in the spirit. Mm-hmm. The spirit isn't inside of you. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where Ephesians is going. Again, here the focus is always the future. What's going to happen in the future? And really, this is right Christian thought for so long. It's all about the future. Mm-hmm. Like when people talk about evangelizing, what do we care about?
Yeah,
where are you going when you die, right? Mm-hmm. I care about your future. And see, that's a problem because I'm living right here. You don't care about right now? That's a problem because God does. Mm-hmm. God's in the present. We talked about, remember?
God is here.
Yeah, right. God is not at the end of the race. God is here. God is with us. So that's a little bit, perhaps a little bit deep for you, but a little bit of understanding. but this is going to really help you when you read Ephesians. Because without that, when you read Ephesians, you go right to our Western mindset. You go right to our philosophical mindset. And you read it Gnostically. And you will never understand about this wholeness that Paul is getting to. Let's talk just a little bit about the purpose of Ephesians then. But before we do that, I want you to look behind me. We have two mascots today. By the way, doesn't it smell wonderful in here?
Yeah.
That's the candle you guys gave me. I wanted you to be able to... Oh, I love that. Again, a physical thing, right? Smelling, physical. I have two mascots behind me. So they're going to be here every week. We're going to do different things with them. Take two sheets of this paper. I'm going to throw some to you guys. What I want you to do is give them names, because we're going to talk about them a lot, so they need names. Give them each names. Look at them just as a Jewish person would wait to name their baby until they saw them. So I want you to look at each of them, name them. So I'm going to ask you first for this one here. So first name that and then pass it in. Fold it over so I don't have that sticky on there. And I'll put it in the bowl and we'll see if we
can. Are they always going to be in that form?
Oh,
who knows? How will we know?
Well, I'm going to name them. They're going to have names next week.
Oh, okay.
So then you'll know. Yes. So as soon as you have a name, just pass it down. Pass it either way so that it comes here. And I can put it in the bowls.
How do you know which one's which?
I just want this one right now.
Oh, okay.
I just want her, right? They're both girls, by the way.
Oh,
that's okay. That's fine. That's fine. No problem.
And are you saying that because of the physical shape? How do you know?
You know what? I've just...
Okay.
In my head, I've always thought of them as sisters. So. Thank you.
Yeah. Does that tell you? Something about our society, perhaps. Did you find them at Hobby Lobby?
Well, I've always had one of them.
Okay.
You know, they're
so
artists and girls. Just that one. I just want that one right now. Okay, now do the other one. Everyone has named her? Now do the one on my left here. Okay, as soon as you're done, pass them in, put it up there by the other girl. And you know, here's the interesting thing. I'm pretty much assuming that we're going to have some kind of coalition with names here. If I have 36 different names for one of them, okay, everybody have their names in. Next week they will greet you with their names on there.
You're not
going to
share?
Not today.
Should we give you
rationale? No, actually, I'm going to give you rationale. So, purpose of Ephesians. Why does Paul write Ephesians? He's looking at these churches in the Greco-Roman world, how they're trying to retie reality. These are churches that know what Jesus Christ has done. And so what he wants to do is be able to reform their identity according to what Christ has done. So they have always had their identity somehow as one of these, this linear or this circular way of thinking. And the interesting thing is, I would say, if you ask somebody in the ancient world, and if you ask somebody today, they would have a hard time verbalizing how they think of themselves. And how they think of themselves in relationship to the spiritual. It would be interesting, you would hear the talk, eventually you would get out with, my guess is, even today, either this or this. You would get that idea. What Paul wants to do is explain to them in different ways. Actually, he wants them to do things so that they begin to understand their wholeness in Christ and what Christ has done. What he wants them to know is, you don't have to retie reality. Christ has done it for you. So that it isn't you striving to put it all together. You don't have to figure out which one goes where and how do I attach them. Christ has already done that. He has revealed, first of all, what the real power structure is. That real power, what did I do with my Mobius? I cut it. Real power, yes, I can remake it, is found this way. This is real power. That's what Christ has actually done. I'm not going to go through up all how he's done that with his birth and death and resurrection, but we know this is who he was, who he is, and who he continues to be. By the way, isn't it cool that it always, almost always looks like a triangle,
yeah,
but a three, four-dimensional triangle? So he's going to reveal the real power structure, where power really resides. It is in shared life. It is never real power in separate life. That might be a huge wake-up call to every man and woman standing in the podiums in the debates for our presidential election, right? Because their whole idea is, how can I separate myself from the rest of these, right? Because that's how we think about power. Who's the best, rather than what does real power look like? So Christ reveals that real power comes from a Mobius. He also has changed our relationship to spiritual power. So remember, spiritual power is always up here because we don't understand it, we don't see it, so we always think of it as higher. So what Christ gives us is an epignostic. Now that is a made-up word, but epignosis is a Greek word. But I thought, well, it's agnostic, gnostic, well then it has to be epignostic. The word is epignosis, and what that word means is full knowledge with participation. So basically, this is epignosis. It is full knowledge with participation, with co-indwelling. And what Christ does is he reveals the mystery of epignosis and how you get there. What Christ has shown us is epignosis is never something you get toward. I know something, so now I know how to do it. This is how we've taught Christianity. If you know, then you can be in this. Christ says epignosis can only be acquired as a gift. Only. It can only be given to you. It cannot be acquired any other way. It cannot be worked toward. It cannot be in anything that you do or say or think. It can only be given as a gift. That, he says and shows, is this perfect reflection of God. So if we put this, we'd have to put the Spirit back. Boy, that makes it a little strange one. Only by receiving, so that an epignosis approach to the spiritual is always a reception. It is not appeasing. It is not by magic. It's not by keeping at a distance. It's always a reception. It's always an openness to being given something. And that openness actually occurs in a bodily presence. How do we know that? Because Christ showed us that. It was his bodily presence that he showed the openness. It was the body that made the separation, and Christ's body made the reconnection. And he makes it available in the present to participate in this Mobius, in this continual open receiving. This is a demonstration of being open always. You know, in my head, when I think about being open to another's life, in the Native American community, in past, when they needed to be warm, and there was a dead animal, do you know what they would do? Yeah, they would crawl inside.
Well, that's only a recent dead.
Right, yeah. Correct, yeah. Correct.
A very old, long dead.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So correct because it had the warmth, right? It had the warmth. And I just want you to have a picture of what it is to be inside of another getting their life. So like that. For that animal to give the life to the human being then gets life to be able to go out and give more life. Just a little bit of a picture of this idea that you are available to participate in the life of that animal. What's different in participating in God's life? It's not a dead animal, right? It's always living. So it is as if you crawled into God, receiving his life. You're open to being vulnerable, needing, so that you can be open and vulnerable to giving. Does that give you a little bit of a different picture of being able to participate in his life as he is giving you his life? All the positions are open. They're open and vulnerable. We've talked about vulnerability a lot, but I think this time we're going to get a better, more concrete idea of what it means to be vulnerable and to be open. It is present participation. I'm not focused on the past or the future, but the present. And here's an interesting thing you'll find in Ephesians. You know the Greek terms aorist or present tense, right? The word walking all the time, you would think it's going to be in the present tense, right? That you continually do it, but it's in the aorist tense, which means that being in the present is I have to be here in the present now. And then I'm here in the present. I can't be in the present continually, right? Because that's the future. I have to be here now. And then the next moment, I have to be in this moment, participating. So it has to do with being in the present, having presence open to the participation, which will bring a wholeness to our identity. Being open to being in the Mobius, but also giving out in the Mobius. I know as I speak about this, sometimes it doesn't seem very concrete, but we're going to get to very concrete in Ephesians as we go through that. So what Paul is wanting to do is to form our identification as people who have the access to participate in this Mobius, perichoresis type of life. Not just the individual, but as the church body. So interesting, as we're talking about bodies and how important they are, that the church is called a body, that it's Christ's body, because that's how we participate in the perichoresis. But it'll also talk about in the family, how it's going to change the identity in the family and how the family will be in the perichoresis dance as well. And lastly, we'll talk about being against the evil forces that are trying to separate. So Satan, all of the angels that are with him, their whole purpose is always to make sure you're this. Separate. That's his whole point. Mm-hmm. Be separate. Because if you're separate, you're not involved in the divine, in the spiritual, in wholeness. That's the whole point. So that being involved in the present in the perichoresis will be glorifying to God, because it will reflect who he is. It will reflect accurately who he is. So, the theme of Ephesians is in him. And every time for me, I think about that. I think about being in that horse. In him, walking in the power of restored unity. So there's going to be a lot of words about power, a lot of words about unity, a lot of words about walking, physically doing something, walking or standing firm. But overall, the in him is the key word in Ephesians. And our verses. So I'd like us to say this together before we end. Ephesians 2, 10, and 4, 1 through 3. I connected them together. 4,
we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand, that we should walk in them. Therefore, walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience and tolerance for one another in love, being diligent to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace.
Father, we thank you. We open ourselves up to you and this week, that we might lay aside the ways we normally think and the ways we normally walk around, that we might allow you to teach us new ways of being participants in your perichoresis, that we might have the joy of your presence in us and us in you. May we celebrate and may we sing out in our movements, in our words, who you are, the God of all wholeness. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. All right, so do your homework. Lesson one is just an overview, and we'll see you next week. Yes. Oh, thank you. So, as always, I really, really would need your help in cleaning up afterwards. So that means bringing the chairs downstairs in the basement. This time, put them on the right side. You'll see it's a little different down there. So put them on the right side. Any dirty dishes into the dishwasher, please. Coffee and stuff all kind of cleaned up. That would be helpful to me. Thank you.